Who gets a 5-star rating? And what does that mean?
Does adolescence obesity affect cardiovascular health later?
Are you taking an aspirin every day?
And the association between income and life expectancy.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on Tax Day, April 15th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, not the tax man, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences System in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, it's hard for me to decide which of these ones I want to start with, so I'm just going to jump in with JAMA Internal Medicine. This was the one I saw first. Relative to these 5-star ratings, those are ratings by CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, of hospitals and their relationship with rehospitalization and mortality.
CMS introduced this 5-star rating system, and it really depends primarily on the patient experience based upon surveys, what are called HCAP, that's the Hospital Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers and Systems. So after the person is admitted to the hospital, later CMS sends them this survey. Based upon that, CMS has developed a star rating system. 1 to 5, 5 being the best and 1 being the worst. Well, the real question is whether there is any association between this rating and patient outcomes. This is a study of over 3,000 hospitals, and in that, about 4% received a 5-star rating, about a fourth received 4-star ratings, half received 3-star, and about a fifth received either 2-star or 1-star. And when they looked at both mortality and hospital readmission, there was a difference between 1-star and 5-star, but not so much between 2-star, 3-star, and 4-star. For example, with regard to mortality, the 5-star hospital mortality, 9.8% versus 11.2% for the 1-star. For readmissions, about 18.7% for the 5-star and 22.9% or 23% for the 1-star. So there does seem to be a correlation at the extremes, but not in the middle.
Obviously, what people are using this kind of data for is to choose where they're going to obtain their health care. And I think that's the primary concern relative to this. Is this really informative for patients?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because we don't think so, or I don't think so, and I have to say that the Association of Academic Medical Centers, AAMC, doesn't think so either, because there are so many different things that go into this. Is it a big hospital or is it a small hospital? Is it urban? What's the socioeconomic status of the individuals? We know that profoundly affects their mortality and readmissions. So I don't want our listeners to confuse this star rating, how the patients felt about their experience, with the actual outcomes, because I think this is a very simplistic study.
Having said that, of course, it's also pretty persuasive when you take a look at it, although I would also say that those differences are really not that big.
As you say, they're very marginal differences. These are related to the patient's experience, and oftentimes the patient really can't gauge whether the processes are right, whether the medications were right. So, Elizabeth, I'm glad you brought this out, because I don't want our listeners to think these star ratings really do correlate well with mortality or readmission.
Okay, since we're talking about mortality, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. A little disconcerting, I think. This idea that income, how wealthy you are, definitely has an impact on your lifespan. And also, where you live in the country.
Elizabeth, in fact, I don't usually request which article or study we're going to preview on the blog, but I'd recommend this one because the amount of data in here is really phenomenal, because the sample included over 1.4 billion person-year observations. It took individuals between the age of 40 and 76, looked at their income, and asked, was there a relationship between their income and their life expectancy? This is data obtained between 2001 and 2014. And if you took the highest 1% of income versus the lowest and looked at males, the average life expectancy differed by 15 years, and for women, it differed by 10 years. And then they looked at some of the variables that seemed to be associated with it, and lifestyle was significantly associated with this. People in the lowest income were more likely to have unhealthy lifestyles, smoking, obesity, lack of exercise, for example. What things didn't correlate very well was access to health care. As you mentioned, there is some geographic differences, and over the last several years, the average life expectancy in the high income has continued to increase. In the low income, there's been either very low or modest increase. So that difference is widening as well. I think this is a fascinating study.
Well, we can certainly speculate on all kinds of things. What would you say are points of intervention that are indicated by this report?
it appears that there's a clear association between low income, education about health behaviors, and obviously life expectancy. So certainly with regard to the preventive things, obesity, smoking, those are things we can interact with both at the educational level and at the policy level as well. As you mentioned, there's geographic differences across the country. There seem to be certain belts where the mortality is particularly higher. In what's called the Rust Belt, there's a much greater difference in life expectancy. We should target those areas. So I think the information allows us to focus on particular populations and particular things we need to do to improve life expectancy.
I guess there's a couple other correlates I'd love to see, and those would be healthcare expenditures in those populations and how those correlate with this whole income disparity and geography.
Well, in this particular study, there was no significant correlation with either access to medical care, whether there was income inequality, labor market conditions.
Well, what we know is that this is all going to get incorporated into policy changes for sure, and that's probably going to result in hopefully some increased equality here.
And so if we don't address these, giving increased access to healthcare isn't going to make a big difference.
That's a good take home. Let's go from here then to something that can make a difference in Annals of Internal Medicine, the USPSTF. Wow, they're at it again, or still, telling us that we should be taking aspirin every day.
This was a fascinating issue of the journal. There were five different articles related to aspirin. I'm going to try to summarize all these articles into a couple key points. One is we know that aspirin is important for secondary prevention of stroke and heart attacks. Once someone's had a heart attack or stroke, aspirin could be beneficial. These studies suggest it's also beneficial for primary prevention in certain populations. Between the ages of 50 and 70, primary prevention of cardiovascular disease, specifically heart attacks, and primary prevention of colorectal cancer. One has to balance this against the risk of bleeding associated with it, because it's clearly associated with an increased risk of gastrointestinal bleeding and hemorrhagic stroke. So how do you put all this together? Well, under the age of 50, there's not any clear benefit for cardiovascular prevention. There may be a benefit for colorectal cancer prevention, but the individuals that benefit can't have an excess risk of bleeding, and we don't see these beneficial effects for cancer prevention until the people have been on it for at least 10 years. What's associated with the increased risk of bleeding? Older individuals, people that take non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications. Bleeding is more common in males. It's more common with diabetes and hypertension as well. When I put all that on the table, Elizabeth, do you take an aspirin?
Just started to do that this morning, as a matter of fact.
I don't. And the reason for that is my cardiovascular risk is low, less than 1% per year. So the benefit's fairly marginal. And I weigh that personally against the risk for bleeding, which, as you know, I ride a bicycle. I'm mostly upright on it, but occasionally fall. The urging is that the physicians would weigh the risk and then talk to the patient about those risks and come to a joint decision about whether aspirin's beneficial.
What is it that's compelling me to choose to take an aspirin? And I'll probably do it every other day. I would say that it's the emerging evidence that I'm seeing that's sometimes anecdotal or observational, but we have discussed in the last couple of years a study relative to aspirin and melanoma prevention. Again, as someone who's on a bicycle a lot during the summer season and getting a lot of UV exposure, I find that to be pretty compelling. I just seem to smell on the horizon burgeoning information relative to prevention in other venues.
And as you know, a lot of my cycling is done on a stationary cycle inside or night riding as well with that UV exposure. Important to weigh the risk and benefits for aspirin.
And it's highly individual. Finally, then, let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine, taking a look at obesity among teenagers and, wow, what's their subsequent cardiovascular disease risk as they age?
This is, again, one of those really large studies, and it was done in Israel, and that's because prior to entering the military at age 17, they do physical exams on all the individuals that would be a part of the military. They have measurements on 2.3 million Israeli adolescents, and they compared body mass index, the upper part of normal range, and noted that there was a clear increase in cardiovascular death. Compared to the lower quartile, they were five times more likely in the higher BMI quartile to die from coronary heart disease, about 2.5 times more likely to die of stroke, and twice as likely to die of sudden cardiac death over the 30 to 40 year follow-up.
Yikes, this is some pretty compelling data.
And again, it's really more compelling because this is considered to be a BMI accepted within the normal range, just at the upper part of it. Now, it doesn't give any insight into the mechanism. Is it because this higher BMI is associated with other risk factors like increased lipids and hypertension? We don't know. Is it some genetic correlation? So an association at best, not causal, with no explanation of the underlying mechanism.
I would also add, though, that there is biological plausibility. And so we know very well from cadaveric studies, for example, that atherosclerosis begins very, very early in life, and that's exacerbated by increased body mass.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, this study doesn't give any insight whether that's the cause or whether it's due to some other reason.
But yet another area that's ripe for policy change, isn't it?
Yeah. So Elizabeth, again on the blog, would you be willing to put on the income and life expectancy article?
I would be delighted. So that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.